Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller. October 24th opens the Tuma Theater's third year of performances. Produced and performed by Native students at the University of Alaska, the Tuma Theater has been a hugely successful blend of Native storytelling, song, and dance with elements of Western theater. It attempts to do justice to authentic Native material in a form that's entertaining for any audience. This fall's show, called Masks of Alaska, will be performed at the AFN Convention in Anchorage, and then it will tour New Zealand and Hawaii, all under the supervision of the group's new director, Steve Crosby. Crosby has a degree in directing and 3 years' experience career counseling Native youth. In this new job, he has the difficult task of trying to improve upon success.
Long term, if I stay involved with the project, I would like to begin developing some full-length plays which can possibly follow through. These are really sketchy ideas at this point, but follow through historically the evolution of many of the cultural groupings in the state. See what has happened to the Tlingit people over the last century or two centuries. The impact of major things such as the arrival of white men. And
can you do that using traditional material? Or are you then becoming something other than what Tuma is, which is mostly a presentation of traditional things in traditional manner? If you're talking about plays and full-length dramas, you're changing it.
I think what we would be doing is it would be a matter of taking the culture, and so the intent of Tuma, as I understand it, and the way that I've been approaching this, is preservation of culture. And this is really portraying what has happened and what the culture was like at a much earlier stage, which is really going back much more to basic roots of the culture, which may not come out in a story format. Stories can also be told in that full-length play so that that wouldn't be lost. Maybe I somewhat misstated what the direction is I had in mind, but in respect of developing full-length plays, that does not mean that we would be sacrificing out or cutting out the storytelling approach as well. But it would be nice to build an entire bank of material that could be used. And if we're performing down in Southeastern, it might be nice to tie in a couple or three types of things, of approaches, performances. Say one would be the full-length play, the other could be an evening of storytelling and that sort of thing.
That's quite ambitious from where the Tuma started, with just mostly the kids getting together and doing it mostly on their own.
Yeah.
And it was not very slick or professional, but it was quite charming. And I talked to the directors then and some of the students then, and they saw a great danger in becoming too performance-minded and too practiced and too slick, because they thought that they would lose some of the inherent charm of what was going on.
There's a big difference between slick and quality performing. I think that a lot of plays that you might see, professional plays that are put on or productions, may be very slick with a lot of lighting and fancy costumes and this sort of thing. Say the performers themselves may be very slick. They may have a lot of totally perfected hand movements. Their voices will be just perfect, with perfect inflections and all of this sort of thing. But they'll never
miss a line.
And they'll never miss a line. But they have no soul. Mm-hmm. They have no commitment to what they're doing. When I'm talking about developing this and tightening up as tightening it as a performing group and as a structure, I think every production should be done the best possible way that it can be within the intent of that group.
And who determines the intent? Is it still sort of for the students and by the students, or is the director becoming more and more imposing his ideas on it? Are you?
No, I don't think so. The intent of the group, or the goals of the group, again, are for the preservation of the culture, mm-hmm. and to make sure that an appreciation of the different cultures within the state are maintained.
Okay.
And that is still very much the focus of this.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is that how do you know you're white, you're not part of the culture, whereas the students who are performing and taking your direction are?
Mm-hmm.
And do they know better sometimes, or do they know better all the time, or how do you work that out?
The balance that I've been striving for, and I think that we have done very well on so far, has been to, my reason for being here is to give them direction from a theatrical standpoint, from a performing standpoint, in no way as an expert or as an authority on the actual material. So that's pretty much the trade-off. We are getting materials in constantly from the group. If they have an idea for a story, then to bring it in, then I will assist them in putting that on so that it can be portrayed the best possible way that it can be through the dramatic format, just through experience in performing and in directing. There are some basic rules that go irregardless. For example, if you have gigantic pauses, and big gaps between segments of a play, the effect that it will have on an audience, regardless of the culture, regardless of who they are, is that it will tend to drag and it will get boring after a period of time. So that's one of the big things I'm trying to do this year. I haven't altered very much many of the stories at all, but just tightening mm-hmm. the show. This is not to say that the group wasn't functioning well last year. It's pretty much something that I am concerned about now, that I want to do the best job that I can to get it to the point where it will maintain the mm-hmm. audience interest the best possible way that it can. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Okay, yeah. the question is phrased, and I guess I tried to come at it in various different phrasing, is what keeps you, what keeps it native and what keeps it honest?
Yeah. Well, there is certainly, there has to be a compromise since the performances go to various places even throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to be performing in Dallas and Houston and in the heartland of white man America, it's, I think, important, again, that we communicate through the means that they can understand. And yet at the same time, it's very, very important that they have an understanding as to what the cultures are that we're representing, and they can get that largely through the native performing format, which is song and dance.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of traveling,
yes,
you're going to New Zealand also. That's quite a trip. Where else are you going?
We're stopping in Hawaii on the way over. And at this point, these are the only trips outside of Alaska. The rest of the performances this year will be in the state. There's a question mark on the funding for this next semester, from January on, the second half of the fiscal year. And so that's one thing that we're working on, is seeing how we can develop a plan for Duma Theater so that it can be a continuing entity with a strong fiscal foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what happens on that over the next couple of months. We're talking out some ideas that are very exciting, whereby the students that are involved in the group will be much more able to spend the time that's required in really getting the show really clean and where it really flows well. But the obvious conflict with students being the performers is that they have classes and mm-hmm. need to devote time to that, especially since that is the primary reason that they're in college. We're working out a plan where they can get a lot of independent study credits, say for one period of time, and work exclusively on Duma Theater, ideally for a year. again, since it hasn't been clearly established yet, I hesitate to say too much more on this, but it is exciting about some of the possibilities.
What kind of credits would they get? Would this, then you'd be limited, maybe if it were theater credits to students that were interested in theater, what about, would you be getting language credits or social science credits?
The ideas that we're talking about now are Alaska Native History, also Alaska Native Studies, English, for the research and the writing up that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And then possibly taking one independent study course in their area of their major, plus speech and drama. So it does come out to where, in talking with representatives from these different departments, they all seem to feel that it's very strong. In talking with the student orientation services people, we're kind of feeling it out with the counselors to see if maybe when a student comes to campus, a Native student comes to campus, that they be appraised of the existence of Duma, and that if they are interested possibly in getting involved, that, say, in another 2 years, that they start tailoring their schedule and their curriculum with that in mind, so that their liberal arts credits could be taken then at that point.
Do you plan any travel to the bush?
This year, the only travel that has been set up, and it's because of too extensive a travel schedule last year where it really hurt the students academically. The only performances that have been scheduled to the bush this year have been, and I guess this isn't really bush, but Kodiak and Cordova. It's not restricted to that at this point, but a close eye is going to be kept on how much performing outside of the Fairbanks area the group will be doing. There are 10 performances in the Fairbanks area in different schools scheduled for the next semester.
I'm wondering about the group's responsibility to perform for the people from whom the material comes. You can get very fancy, go to New Zealand, go to New York, open on Broadway. You know, it doesn't matter. But do you have a responsibility to keep returning this material? These kids go to their grandparents, their aunts and uncles, and get the stories. They go to their grandmothers and say, make me, you know, a costume. Is there a responsibility to return the performance every once in a while to the various groups?
The emphasis should be on Alaska, not outside. The ideas that we've talked out at this point have been that, say, one full semester would be spent in Alaska performing throughout the state, and, say, a third of a semester or possibly like two trips be taken outside of the state, and only to places where it would be worthy of going. For example, an American Indian conference in Minneapolis or something. It would be worthy of the Alaska Native people being represented at that.
Why do you think it's so wildly successful, no matter what they do? Mm-hmm. They've had good shows and bad shows. They've had great performances where, you know, they've all gotten together. They've had some real crummy ones, but they've still been accepted no matter what they do. They seem to, you know, once they get on stage, something, you know, seems to work with the audience. Why is that?
I think it's because, partly because of the novelty of it. There is no such thing as Alaskan Native theater. This is the first attempt, I think, as far as I'm aware of. And I think that that's very exciting, and particularly among the Native people, this is very, very exciting and something that they're going to be totally supportive of, and regardless of the cleanliness, say, of the performance, the audience is going to be extremely forgiving just because it exists. They're seeing something that they have not seen before that directly relates to themselves and preservation of something that they've been fearing and seeing destroyed, or would be destroyed, or lost.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Steve Crosby, director of the Tuma Theater. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Every time you look at Denali, you know that there's been past people that saw the same mountain the way you saw it. So I would say that I see it Denali because my grandfather saw Denali.
Robert Charlie's grandfather saw the mountain as Denali, so did his grandfather's grandfather and countless ancestors before. President William McKinley of Ohio never saw it, and his grandfather probably never knew it existed. In 1975, the Alaska legislature passed a resolution restoring the name Denali to North America's highest peak within the state. Since then, groups and individuals have been lobbying the federal government to follow suit. It almost has. The United States Board on Geographic Names has also voted to reinstate the name Denali, but the state of Ohio objects, and it has taken the issue to Congress in the form of a rider to a D-2 amendment. And as long as D-2 is active, the Board on Geographic Names will wait. In the meantime, it is called for hearings on the name change for early November. They take place in Salt Lake City and Washington, D.C., both a long way from the Alaska Range. Robert Charlie of the Tanana Chiefs Conference is drumming up support for the name change, or we should say he'd like to have the mountain's original name recognized by the nation.
Yes, it's been an ancient name for our ancestors. They've been using that name many times over and over. Really, the word of our grandfathers has been brought up through generations and passed on. And the way our Athabascan people were recognized by their own group from different areas in Alaska is by the way our forefathers had made their speeches. And their speeches were always directed by a name place, which would be the landmark of such and such an area. Okay, Denali has been mentioned in a lot of speeches during the events like the Neutral Wire down in Tanana, mm-hmm. the thing they hold there every year. And if there was an Athabascan that came up to talk to during our Tanana Chiefs Convention, he would also mention the Denali in his speeches here in the convention. I really support that Denali be back to its to original name by the nation, and I think that it's just a way that I express my feeling that I would support my culture and my heritage. I think as far as using our language in these modern days, what I know has been dropped by our young people for the last 10 or 20 years. And I know there's quite a bit of change because most of the kids nowadays want to speak English. But the word Denali, I think, will live on forever if we ever come back and start using the word Denali. Denali is being used by numerous companies and schools and by other organizations throughout the state of Alaska.
The name Denali is common property in Alaska now. In Athabascan tradition, great speeches were made around the name, and chiefs would show respect for each other's place names by recalling them during important gatherings and ceremonies. Having knowledge of Native place names and using them is one way the federal government can show its respect for Native tradition. Jim Carey of the Alaska Native Language Center has another reason why the mountain should have a place name instead of a person's name.
Well, one point is that Athabascan place names are never for people and individuals. They do not make commemorative names for any geographic features as a rule. And certainly, they, I feel Athabascans would react strongly against a personal name for this, the most prominent geographic feature in Alaska. That's just not their way of doing things. And furthermore, I don't think people who are used to the name McKinley feel that changing the name should in any way dishonor President McKinley, because there are, of course, many, many geographic features in Alaska which have taken the name McKinley and will continue to take the name, such as McKinley Fork and McKinley National Park, and none of these names are proposed to be changed.
Robert Charlie has written a letter summing up his position. The letter is entitled Tradition Instead of Vanity, and he suggests that naming the mountain to flatter Ohio was a mistake in the first place.
In my letter, I addressed that point also. And in my letter, I wrote that the name being used today has no meaning compared to that used by our forefathers, signifying a landmark for our Athabascan people, Denali. The name McKinley is only a second name that should have not been allowed. The use of the name McKinley is proof that the federal government has neglected our rights as citizens to voice our opinion on what the mountain should be called. And I think back when they started all this, it takes us back to when our Athabascan people had little to say or knowledge enough to say, to have an input. But now that we have generations that's coming up who may face future problems. And what I'm trying to say is that I believe that this name, I think, was handed down, and I try and protect the rights of our people by keeping our heritage.
Why, I can understand why Athabascans would want the name to be Denali and be in strong support. But what about other people in Alaska? What about folks from the North Slope or Southeast? Is there a reason why they should want the name returned to Denali?
Now, if you're thinking that why would they support something that the Athabascans support? I don't think we see things like that. I think the Native people in Alaska have a unity. I think they try to support each other when they see a need. Mm-hmm. And based on those needs is where we communicate with each other the best.
One of the other things I wanted to talk about is, besides why you think it's important to have the name changed, is what the name means.
Denali in Athabascan, name the tall one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then it can also mean a peak, where it's the highest. So there's no doubt Denali is a good word for Denali.
Yeah, there's a point here we should get into about the vast systems of place names that the Athabascans had in all the Native cultures of Alaska had for describing their local regions. And for example, in the Cook Inlet area in the Dena'ina language, we today have recorded over 1,200 place names for many, many obscure small features, the large portion of which are not named on the maps today by any sort of name. And for the Athabascans, knowledge of the territory was literally their meat, because the hunters and the fishermen, both men and women, they covered large areas. And part of the ways in which young people learned the system was to learn the names for these places and these complicated sequences of names, which were very much for safety and orientation in getting around the land. And of course, there were no written records of this land, and it's particularly impressive for us today to make lists of these names and realize how detailed they were and how stable and conservative the names were too, because there's very little disagreement on these systems of names. If you ask two elders how they call various creeks, they almost invariably agree in the finest details. And I don't think today, even with maps and the written literacy tradition in Western culture, that very, very many people have a geographic knowledge that begins to approach that an Athabascan, a traditional Athabascan, had and knowing his territory.
So that unchartered wilderness actually is well chartered.
It's covered with names all around the villages in Alaska. And also, it's important to recognize that the USGS maps reflect this very fragmentarily and very inaccurately. In most cases, only in very haphazard ways have Native names been preserved, and in almost all of those cases, they've been misspelled in a very poor way so that non-Athabascan speakers and then at times even younger generation people from that culture learn a wrong pronunciation for the names in their area. And it is possible that by establishing the name Denali, we could create a more sensitive attitude to preserving Aboriginal place names in Alaska, such as has been done in Hawaii. If people are aware of the really beautiful and detailed system of place names in Hawaii that was preserved from around the turn of the century, I see no reason why Alaska can't have a sensitive policy to preserve Aboriginal names, particularly on unnamed features, because for generations in the future, this will become an important element of the heritage.
Can we have a definitive pronunciation of Denali? I've heard Denali.
In Koyukon, it's Denali. If Robert were pronouncing it from his native village of Minto, it would be pronounced slightly differently.
Mm-hmm. How do you do it?
Dinavit. Yeah, that's another point. The fact is that the Athabascans of the interior and the area north of the range all had a pronunciation variant in the different languages of the name Denali. Denali itself is coming from the Koyukon language, but the other names were similar in pronunciation, such as Denazi, Denathi, Denglathi, and so forth. But these are minor pronunciation variants of the same name. Also, south of the range, in the two Athabascan languages of that area, Atna and Denaina, they used a separate name for the mountain, which was pronounced either Degalai Ka'a or Degalai Ka'a in Atna and in Denaina. And that means mountain big. But at this point in time, I don't think people in that area would argue that their name should be substituted instead of Denali. That's not an important point right now, I don't think.
The important thing seems to be that Alaska has been able to reach a consensus on the name. It prefers to call its highest mountain Denali. And while it's a statewide issue, Robert Charlie thinks it's only appropriate that the Athabascan people take the lead in campaigning for the name change.
They're asking for comments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, who would be the ones to give comments in that regards to a word that's, that really mean a lot to them?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Athabascan people. If we don't get up and say, hey, we can't support our name. We don't want to support Denali. People will think we're crazy or something. You know, so that's the reason why it surfaced. I'm sort of spearheading this project.
And if you had enough time and money, you might go to Utah or into Washington to push the case further.
I sure would like to see that. I think if whoever wants to participate, who wants to get involved in this matter, I think we could, if we can get together and come up with some ideas, I think it'll really help us along and try to help somebody get out there and be at these hearings. And I would think that if we're ever going to the hearings, I think we better do it with an Athabascan to go out there and say, hey, this, I'm talking from myself.
Robert Charlie of the Tananaw Chiefs Conference. We also heard from Jim Carey of the Alaska Native Language Center. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.